This is a special live taping of the recent interview with Nick Gillespie. My guests today are two fierce defenders of free speech and open expression, Jacob Mishangama and Jeff Kossoff, who are the co-authors of the new book, The Future of Free Speech. Jacob is the founder of The Future of Free Speech, a research institution attached to Vanderbilt University, where he's also a research professor. He's the author also of the definitive book on the subject, Free Speech, A History from Socrates to Social Media. Jacob, thanks for coming out.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
Okay, and Jeff Kossoff is a former journalist, maybe a future journalist if your academic career doesn't work out, a former journalist who's a senior legal fellow at the Future of Free Speech, and the author of a trilogy of mind-blowing books, and I've interviewed him for each one of those, The 26 Words That Invented the Internet, which is an explanation and defense of Section 230, The United States of Anonymous, which is a defense of anonymous speech, and then his most recent one before this book, and probably your most provocative, Liar in a Crowded Theater, which is a defense of false speech. So you're taking it easy when you're just talking about the future of free speech, right?
Yeah, this was a...
Okay, so this book explores what you guys call the global free speech recession, which is a decades-long decline in internet freedom, free expression, civil and political rights generally. Let's start by sketching in the details of the free speech recession. Jacob, why don't we start with you? What's going on when you say, you know, starting about 20 years ago, after a kind of a 50-year period at least where it seemed like everybody was having more speech and more ability to talk freely, express themselves. Something happened. What is the free speech recession?
Well, let me start 30 years ago, 1996. John Perry Barlow of the Grateful Dead writes the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace, where he says that we're constructing a world where anyone can say anything without any limits. And that, I think, expressed sort of the techno-optimistic spirit of the age, where freedom and democracy had been spread everywhere, and the internet would make authoritarianism and censorship.
Right. And this is, you know, the Cold War is over, yes. Communism lost.
Apartheid loses power, and so on. And there was a time where that seemed to be true. You know, that we also had Bill Clinton in 2000, you know, he wants China to join the World Trade Organization. Right. He says, China wants to do internet censorship. Well, good luck with that. That's like nailing Jell-O to a wall, and then he laughed it off. Not so funny anymore. But when you look closer to the data, you see that in the early 2000s, actually, authoritarian states had learned to reverse engineer the promise of technology to supercharge censorship and surveillance. Mm-hmm. And then we have a momentous shift around 2016 in democracies, because that's when social media and the internet goes from being good to being bad because of the, you know, most prominently, the election of Donald Trump, which the story goes, it's Russian disinformation spread on social media that essentially convinces American simpletons to vote for Donald Trump. That theory has been pretty seriously debunked, I think. But that really is a game changer in institutional
not necessarily attitudes. That people in America are simpletons, but they came to their own conclusion. I mean, it was certainly disinformation.
I mean, there was Russian disinformation. There were Russian attempts to influence the elections. But it's just not the case that, you know, if you're a Hillary Clinton supporter in 2016, you log on to Facebook and you see something that says Donald Trump, very good. And then you suddenly change your mind, and then you go.
I never thought of it that way.
But it changes institutional attitudes, and then you have the infodemic with the pandemic, and now we live sort of in the third wave of what we call elite panic with AI, and this idea that deep fakes and so on will drown democracy. So I would say that in democracies, we live in an age where free speech is seen as a Trojan horse that undermines democracy, whereas 20 years ago, free speech was seen as a competitive advantage against authoritarianism.
Right, and I guess there's also that moment in, 2010 with the Arab Spring, where Twitter was the thing that underwrote the Arab Spring and the color revolutions, and we're like, wow, you know, John Perry Barlow was right. You know, there's nothing that can stop this. So talk... you know, in the book, you guys show how, you know, Freedom House and a couple of other indices have just shown for 15 years, internet freedom has been declining, 19 years, civil liberties have kind of been declining. What form does that take, Jeff, in authoritarian countries first? And then we'll, let's talk a little bit about democracies.
So it's much more stark in authoritarian countries. It's although it's interesting because the reasons that they censor in authoritarian countries often sound the same as what we're hearing in democracies in Europe and the United States. And two of the big reasons are children and national security. We want to protect the children. We want to protect national security. Russia has really closed off a lot of its internet, and its initial endeavor into doing that was under the guise of protecting children from harmful material, which sounds somewhat familiar to what we see other places.
And especially, I want to, towards the end, when we talk more about America, we'll talk about social media and the effects on kids. I mean, it's funny when you think back to the 90s, certainly, The Simpsons had a running gag where whenever any issue came up, there was a female character who would shout out, "Will someone think of the children?" I mean, it had become a joke, yeah. Right? That, oh, you know, we have to think about the children. And now we are thinking about the children totally unironically.
Absolutely. And I mean, every headline that you're seeing right now about these new speech restrictions, I mean, just this morning, I thought it was a joke when I saw that the head of the EU, and I forgot her exact title, but Jacob can correct
Ursula
me.
Von der Leyen.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. So she put out an announcement that there's a new EU age verification app. Like, it was this great new product, like provide your personal information to the EU and you could verify yourself to speak on social media. And I'm thinking that's insane. I'm not going to provide my personal information to the EU government so I could use the internet. But I mean, that's the way they're thinking. And it's because they're saying we want to protect children from these unspecified harms. And we're seeing this all around the world, and it's happening very, very quickly. I wrote a book about an anonymous speech 3 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, and I knew it was in danger, but it's really on the verge of collapse in the next few years because of these attempts.
Can you talk a bit about what happened in Russia after the collapse of communism? And Russia, I mean, it's probably not the best case. And I want to talk about the EU because that, you know, that's closer to what we have here, and the U.S. and the EU are weirdly twinned together. And, you know, we seem to now be kind of entering an EU phase when it comes to speech regulation. But did speech increase with the collapse of communism? And then when did it start getting reeled in?
No, there was certainly an opening already under Gorbachev, but also after the collapse of communism, you had independent media. You could use the internet. Where it really, really starts to collapse is in 2012. Putin sort of changes the constitution. He runs for president again, and he's really, really disturbed by the fact that there are these anti-regime protests in Moscow, and they're all organized on social media, on Facebook and VKontakte. And so he says, we need to do something about it. And so they create the so-called Red Web. And as Jeff rightly said, the initial justification for sort of creating a centralized censorship regime in Russia is protecting the children. You see something very similar soon after Xi Jinping takes power in China. There's a secret document called Document Number 9, which is a communique to the Chinese Communist Party where Xi Jinping is famously paranoid, and he sort of says, you know, we have to keep all Western ideas about constitutionalism because the internet is extremely dangerous. This was a fatal flaw in Viktor Orban's plan. He managed to control traditional media, but he was a rookie authoritarian because he failed to clamp down on the internet.
In China, I mean, obviously there's more freedom of information and freedom of movement and maybe not economic freedom, but prosperity than there was 30 or 40 years ago. I remember Wired, this would have been sometime in the late 90s, talked about the firewall, the great firewall of China. Nobody took it seriously. Was there also a moment where people in China were just pulling in information that they would never have been able to, and then that got choked down by Xi?
Well, I mean, there was a moment where there was more, but I mean, the crackdown obviously happened a lot earlier. So you have like Tiananmen Square, right?
Yeah.
So that happens before we get the internet. But China is a country that has technological capabilities that near rival those of the U.S., and they're not shy to use those technological capabilities to create, you know, imagine the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century with the technological capabilities of modern day China. Like, what would a Hitler, what would a Stalin do with those powers? That would really have been even more frightening.
Yeah, I was going to say, oh, that would have been really bad, right? Like, you know, it's a good thing they didn't have them.
And I think in many ways they're able to do it in a way where it doesn't necessarily feel as suffocating, just because you're able through data, through AI, to survey people in real time and really cause them to self-censor in ways that you couldn't in the analog world, where you needed someone in a trench coat to follow you around.
And it's also, I guess, different, you know, when you think about texts like 1984, surveillance always is happening as economic conditions are degrading. But in places like China, not Russia, but China, you know, everybody's doing better. So it's a weird, like, you're more willing
I mean, the official narrative obviously is that this is the price for progress.
Right.
Then, you know, we talk about Taiwan, you can, which paints a very different picture, but.
And I want to get to Taiwan too, because that seems, you guys hold that up as a great model of radical transparency that the U.S. could learn something from. Jeff, before we move to the EU, what was going on in America? You know, I mean, obviously there's throughout whatever we want to call the West, there's a march towards, you know, more freedom of the press or of, you know, escapes from censorship. But after World War II, there was this kind of 50-year period where, you know, I mean, I grew up in the 70s, and it's hilarious to think that, you know, George Carlin's Seven Dirty Words were banned from the radio, and then by 2000, you're not even listening to the radio anymore. What was going on that expanded speech so much in America and the West?
So we had a solid core of Supreme Court justices who applied neutral principles to very difficult cases. And in the book, we go through this and we look at four particularly hateful men who had speech that most people would not stand up and say, I agree with, or I will defend the merits of the speech. But they brought their cases to the Supreme Court for various reasons. The first was someone named Jay Neer, who in the 1930s published a really vile anti-Semitic newspaper in Minneapolis. And the district attorney got an injunction to shut it down under a public nuisance law. And the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, these were mostly close cases, not all of them, the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. That's a prior restraint on speech. And that's one of the most abhorrent things that the government can do to speech to stop it from ever happening. And you might think, well, why would you want to defend Jay Neer and what he was doing? Well, that precedent would be cited in so many other cases involving prior restraints, including the Pentagon Papers case, that the Supreme Court relied on that. We talk about someone named Arthur Terminiello, who's a defrocked Catholic priest who gives a speech, an anti-Semitic speech in Chicago that causes riots outside, and he's charged, and the Supreme Court overturns his conviction. That case ends up being used to overturn the convictions of 187 black civil rights protesters in South Carolina in the 1960s. We then talk about Clarence Brandenburg, a KKK leader in Ohio, who basically his case, when his conviction gets overturned, really resets the precedent for that's used for free speech and protests that cause a lot of chaos. And finally, we look at the Westboro Baptist Church and Fred Phelps, who really said awful, abhorrent things at military funerals. And his case goes up to the Supreme Court because he's sued by the family member of a fallen soldier. And that case, in an 8-1 decision, the Westboro Baptist Church ends up winning. And that's, again, been used by so many other speakers. So we've had some pretty courageous Supreme Court justices who could very easily just say that there's no value in the speech and I'm not going to use the law to protect it. And they went the other way.
So, I mean, what I'm hearing is we really owe anti-Semites, you know, in a big way, right? And also homophobic Christian preachers. But so there's the legal part of it, which is amazing and remains super important. But then there's also technology, right? Obviously, the internet kicks in the 90s, and there's a real legal struggle over that because the U.S. government was ready to regulate the internet, kind of similar to broadcast networks, and that got struck down also by the Supreme Court. But, you know, how important is technology in escaping, you know, censorship, even if it turns out to be a double-edged sword?
Are you talking about now or a few years ago? Because the answer will be different, unfortunately.
Well, let's talk about now.
I mean, the Supreme Court, at least when you're talking about the U.S., the Supreme Court has tried to at least approach the internet in a fairly neutral manner. And starting in 1997, when it struck down most of the Communications Decency Act, the Supreme Court said, we're not going to treat the internet like we treat broadcast. We're going to give it the full scope of First Amendment protections. And overall, the courts have been pretty good. And the courts over the past 30 years have generally been good. We've seen some cracks in some of the rulings. There were two rulings last year that were particularly concerning. The first was when the Supreme Court upheld the law that required TikTok to either find a new owner or shut down. And what's concerning about it is not particularly about TikTok, but about the really light manner in which the Supreme Court treated the possibility of shutting down a platform for speech for 150 million Americans. And then the other case involved an age verification law in Texas that applied to adult websites. And you might think, well, that's understandable. And there were valid reasons for it, but the problem is that it's hard to reconcile that with some of their other internet speech protective rulings. And there's a very good, strong likelihood that that case could be used to further erode online speech protections.
We'll come back to the U.S. Let's talk about the EU because, you know, you expect authoritarian countries to crack down on speech or to try and control speech. What's going on with the EU? Because it, you know, the EU is, you know, it's a free trade zone, certainly within its, within its borders and technologically savvy. What's the arc of how the EU is now treating speech?
Well, so first of all, we have to acknowledge that there's like a fundamental philosophical difference between the American and European approach to free speech. And there are even philosophical differences between various different European states. So America enjoys the strongest constitutional protection of political speech of any country probably in history. That is very different from Europe, where, for instance, all members of the European Union have laws that criminalize hate speech. In fact, it's an obligation under EU law. The European Union has also adopted the Digital Services Act, which is an attempt to create order in the so-called Wild West of cyberspace. You also see at a member state level that this elite panic that I talked about has taken a grip, I think, of a lot of European democracies. This is why you see in a country like Germany, they have these days of coordinated actions against hate speech where police will show up in private homes. If people have written stuff on social media, it can be insults against politicians. It can be sarcastic memes. It can be bona fide hate speech, however you want to define it, and police confiscate their devices. My home country, Denmark, one of my greatest successes as a free speech advocate was to help abolish our blasphemy ban in 2017. Then these far-right activists started burning Qurans, and Denmark was threatened by ISIS and others, and the Danish government just caved and said, you know what, we're just going to criminalize the desecration of sacred text, and we reintroduced a blasphemy ban, and that would not fly in the United States. And I think there is at this moment in Europe really a sense that online free speech is a threat to stability, to democracy. And now, something that you would never have dreamt about hearing from democracies is this concept of digital sovereignty. So digital sovereignty might have made sense, like if you're talking about industrial politics or infrastructure, but now digital sovereignty is being extended to the information and ideas. Basically, this idea that the European Union and member states should be able to have a say in what type of speech their citizens can share and access. And that, I think, is a pretty bad sign for the future of free speech.
You know, before we go on, you guys talk about a fascinating episode in Germany. I think it was in the late 50s or early 60s it was a Russian plot, but where Russian agents kind of did a lot of, kind of graffiti and whatnot of swastikas, which then the West German government was like, okay, we got to crack down on this kind of speech. So Russian agents kind of produced hate speech laws. Can you talk a little bit about that and why that, this is troubling for all sorts of reasons?
So it's 1959 in Cologne, and during Kristallnacht in 1938, the synagogue had been desecrated by Nazi thugs, and it had so recently been rebuilt and reopened. And so on Christmas Day 1959, citizens of Cologne woke up to swastikas and anti-Semitic slogans scribbled on this synagogue, and it spread to countries all around the world. It was called the swastika epidemic, and it prompted Western Germany to expand its laws against incitement to hatred, and also a UN convention criminalizing hate speech. The problem was that this is based on an author called Thomas Ridd, who's written a great book called Active Measures. He documents that this was actually inspired by Russian, like KGB Active Measures. It was the first leader of KGB's office for disinformation, a guy called, I think, Ivan Agayans, an Armenian, who actually thought that press freedom in the West was the greatest advantage that the Soviets had. He said something along the lines that if the West didn't have press freedom, we would have to invent them for it, because it was his way of sort of planting fake news in the media. So Russian fake news inspired hate speech laws in the West, which is a little known fact.
Yeah. It's an amazing irony, and the book is filled with kind of vignettes or episodes like that. And today, Russia uses EU hate speech laws to justify its crackdowns on speech.
Yeah, so
it's like a whatever the opposite of a virtuous circle or a cycle is, right?
Yeah, Germany adopted this law against online illegal speech in 2017, and within 2-3 years, Russia, Venezuela, Belarus, Honduras, Egypt, and other countries had adopted their own versions where they cited the German example. Of course, they did it in bad faith. They would have done it anyways, but it gave them sort of whataboutery points.
You know, is in the EU and in its member states, is it really just kind of, is it a fear of Islamic terrorism? Is it a fear of disorder, or is it just something in the European mind that, they don't like, conversations that get out of control?
I like writing about American free speech law. So it's been eye-opening for me, because this is the first time that I've really went in depth on European law before, and to talk with Jacob and hear the reasoning. And it's always valid. I mean, there's very little ill intent that I see. I mean, I think the logic behind the restrictions isn't fully thought out, but overall it's, fear of what hateful speech could do, and fear of persecution of certain groups, and national security concerns. I think the concerns are similar in the United States than they are in Europe. The difference is that we have the First Amendment to hopefully stand in the way of some of the worst
ideas. I realize this is probably an impossibly deep question to ask for a quick answer to, but what went into, the First Amendment? Because, we've had the First Amendment since the founding of the country, but it was only interpreted in the way that we recognize it now. Really, I mean, you can say before World War II, but it's really mostly after World War II. It's exactly the same text, and yet it was not this kind of glorious free speech document until, you know, relatively recently.
Because part of it is driven by nine people with nine different agendas and nine different philosophies. And frankly, one of the biggest turning points was one person changing his mind in 1919, which was Oliver Wendell Holmes, who wrote the opinion that has been quoted as saying you can't yell fire in a crowded theater in early 1919. During that summer, there were some free speech scholars who worked with him on to educate him. And in the fall of 1919, he had a very similar case. These were going after people for criticizing the military. He came to the complete opposite conclusion and wrote a famous dissent that articulated the marketplace of ideas, which at the time was just basically him and Brandeis, but it had influence over many decades later, and it sort of built momentum. So, I mean, a lot of it really comes down to who the nine people are who are setting that tone.
But I will also say that I think America and Europe has taken different lessons from problematic histories. So in America, you look at Jewish groups, black civil rights groups, they were actually instrumental in defeating early hate speech laws because they said, you know what? Initially they were in favor of these kinds of laws, but they saw them as backfiring. They were saying, okay, if we adopt these kinds of laws, we're a minority, we're being discriminated against, we're being persecuted, we live with two-tier legal systems. If you adopt laws that restrict free speech, they're going to be adopted and enforced by the majority. How does that leave me? I depend on the majority to protect my rights, the very majority that has persecuted me. And then they had all kinds of other things like the Marter effect and so on. Mm-hmm. So in the Brandenburg case about the KKK, not only did you have Thurgood Marshall, the first black Supreme Court justice, agreeing with the 9-0 decision, but you also had a black and a Jewish lawyer defending a member of the KKK. Not because they agreed with that person, but because they saw very clearly that their freedom, their equality, depended on a principle consistent of protection of fundamental rights. And that is just not the logic that underpins the European approach to free speech, which is much more based on the idea of militant democracy, saying, you know, we cannot allow the enemies of democracies to grow so strong that they can use free speech to abuse free speech because they will then destroy democracy. And there were Supreme Court justices, thoughtful Supreme Court justices in the U.S. who thought the same way, and they could have won the debate, but fortunately they didn't.
You guys talk a lot about the Sullivan v. Times decision as well, which allowed for a tightening up of defamation laws so that it was easier for public figures to be attacked in the press or just in common conversation. This is a good way to turn to the U.S. What was the import of that decision, and where are we kind of standing now when it comes to the issues that were raised by it?
Well, so Sullivan was a civil rights case because it was an ad that was taken out in the New York Times by civil rights groups about how Southern officials had treated protesters. And the gist of the ad was correct, but it had some material inaccuracies in it. And the case goes to trial in Alabama in a court with an all-white jury, and a very large verdict is issued against the New York Times. And the New York Times brings this up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court finds this constitutional protection for lawsuits that are brought by public officials, saying that they have to recover damages, they have to show actual malice, which is knowledge of falsity or reckless disregard, which is essentially that they entertain serious doubts about the truth of the speech. And that would be extended to public figures, and it built other precedents that were used for freedom of press and freedom of speech. So that's really been something that's gotten a lot of criticism and a lot of support. There are people who criticize, including two Supreme Court justices, Gorsuch and Thomas, who say that Sullivan basically encourages irresponsible journalism and reckless journalism and so forth. The media very strongly defends Sullivan and says that this gives the breathing space to be able to investigate and criticize public figures and public officials. But it is a Supreme Court opinion. It's nine people. So far we have two justices saying that they would like to at least revisit the Sullivan opinion, but it takes four justices to agree to hear a case, and we haven't gotten those other two votes yet. But obviously, that could happen in the future.
Can you put that in the context of the recent Afro Man decision? Because he's the hero that we didn't know we needed, but. And I guess it was the cops were the ones who brought the defamation suit, right? They were saying he defamed them in his songs. And there's a long history of people, including Henry Ford and others, who insist on bringing a defamation case against somebody. And then it always ends up blowing up in their face. But what happened in the Afro Man case?
So that was actually most of the claims in that case were privacy related claims. And they ended up. He ended up losing in a jury verdict there. But so that wasn't as clear cut of an application of Sullivan. There was a defamation claim, but I can't remember if that was dismissed earlier or if the defamation claim went to the jury. But the privacy claims were found to not have merit, or at least the jury returned a verdict for Afro Man.
And the interesting thing here is to compare that to a number of, say, European countries. The former vice chancellor of Germany, member of the Green Party, Robert Habeck, for instance, had a person fined for calling him a piece of and then a poop emoji. Like he seriously like used the resources of the German state to go after someone who said something.
They really are messed up about excretory functions, aren't they? They're very particular.
And he had like 800 cases where he sort of used, where he went after people who called him various things. The current chancellor has gone after people who called him a racist asshole. I mean, imagine that imagine every American president who had been called something similar had an actionable claim, against anyone who called them something similar, right?
Right.
15% of the American population would be.
let's talk about
prosecuted.
Specific things happening now. Is Donald Trump, who has, he brought a case against a pollster who mistakenly predicted that he would lose the election. His Justice Department has gone after law firms that have defended people he didn't like. Does he represent, as big a threat to free speech as we're seeing in places like the EU?
Yes. I think that it's been interesting to see the reactions on both sides to what's happened in the past year. We've seen some people principled who are concerned about what's happening in the EU and what's happening in the United States. We've also seen some people who are only concerned about what's happening in one place, depending on who's doing it. Suing pollsters, going after broadcasters, that's all very alarming.
Yeah. I would go further and say without the First Amendment, Trump is more punitive and more willing to punish his opponents than the European Union.
But he's more restrained.
He's more unhinged.
But the legal structures.
Yeah, he's more restrained.
It harder for him.
But he will. I still think it has a chilling effect. Like, so even though you might know that you're going to win the case, or there's a strong likelihood that you'll win the case, are you willing to take on the most powerful man in the world, who will use his bureaucracy to go after you, even if the case is meritless? For instance, I'm here on a green card. I've spoken to a lot of people who are not US citizens who will not say anything critical about the administration on social media because they fear for their immigration status. Because there have been these high profile cases, admittedly, there haven't been that many, and they look like they're going to lose them. But I mean,
But that's the point of a chilling effect.
Think about Christopher Hitchens, what he wrote, right, like before he became a U.S. citizen, what he wrote about Bill Clinton and others. Like,
right,
what would people have said if you'd said, you know what, We're going to deport Christopher Hitchens because he criticized a U.S. president. Everyone
instead,
would have said
the government just gave him cancer, like they do to all critics, right? So, well, let's talk about the other parts of the way in which the U.S. is trying to control speech. One of the things you talk about specifically political speech, the attacks on rulings like Citizens United, which allowed corporate entities to spend essentially unlimited amounts of money as long as they're in political electioneering communications, as long as they're not coordinating with campaigns. Is there a new crackdown on political speech making?
Right now there's not, because of Citizens United. We've had a number of amendments, I can't even count how many, that have been proposed in Congress to overturn Citizens United. And the way they're doing it, proposing it, is very alarming because some of the proposals say only natural persons have constitutional rights. So you think, well, what happens to the ACLU or the NRA or the NAACP? And what happens to newspapers, for example? So they haven't passed, but it's alarming how many of them have been proposed. In terms of other attempts on political speech, Jacob's probably going to get sick of hearing me talk about this, but what really inspired me to write my last book was something that happened in 2021, really at the height of the COVID pandemic. There was a bill that was introduced in the Senate called the Health Misinformation Act. So you know that it's got to be a good bill. And it said, so Section 230, which is the law that protects websites and platforms from liability for user speech, it says they don't get these protections for any algorithmically promoted health misinformation. And you think, oh, what's health misinformation? Let's go to the definition section. And it says health misinformation is determined in guidance by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. So I was on a panel with a very strong supporter of this bill, and I was raising alarms. I was talking with anyone I could about how dangerous this was to have an unelected bureaucrat deciding what speech could trigger liability. And I said, this is just imagine how this could be misused. And this supporter said, well, Joe Biden's president, and we agree with what he says. And with what his administration would do. And I said, well, there might be someone who's Secretary of Health and Human Services who you disagree with and who might have a different view of health misinformation. And I was just being alarmist. And,
now we have a Secretary of Health and Human Services who talks about snorting cocaine off of toilet seats, right? And dumping bear carcasses in Central Park. So problem solved.
Exactly.
Right.
There was nothing to worry about.
Yeah. So misinformation is a big thing, right? I mean, people are constantly, or various types of people are trying to criminalize misinformation, which is ultimately what? It really can't be defined. And Jeff, I mean, you would argue, even if it is wrong and is the person saying it knows it's wrong, it should still be allowed.
Overall, I mean, there are some narrow categories like perjury. If you go into court and you lie, you're going to face consequences. If you commit fraud, you're going to face consequences. But the point is they're very narrowly defined exceptions, and there's not just sort of the Supreme Court in 2012 very clearly said there is not a general exception to the First Amendment for false speech. And the government said we don't want, or the court said we don't want a ministry of truth dictating what people can say. And I think that's the right way to go.
Yeah, Jeff is a big supporter of stolen valor, meaning like he likes people who lie about their military service. And it's a good thing too. And there's more of them around than you think, including many people like, who's the Connecticut Senator Dick Blumenthal, who I just saw recently was talking about people lying, and it's like he famously lied about his Vietnam experiences. Jacob, talk about jawboning, because this is something that, the Biden, it gets complicated, right? Because the government during COVID, including when Trump was in office the first time, was kind of leaning on social media platforms, not quite saying you have to end this or don't run this or don't amplify this, but they jawboned. Like they were pushing social media platforms to do it. This became a big thing when Elon Musk took over Twitter, released what became known as the Twitter files. There's a version of that with Facebook. How is jawboning a threat to free speech in America?
You know, if you run a social media platform, you probably, especially if it's a big one, you have a strong profit motive. And so the government has all kinds of ways it can regulate you. And so if you receive a phone call from the White House saying, that's a nice platform you have there, it would be a shame if something happened to it. So you might think about removing COVID information, or not even saying it as directly as that. You know, given an offer you can't refuse. That obviously incentivizes platforms to remove certain types of information, even if there's not a formal legal request. And so there were these communications during Biden, but also under Trump. And we see them now in the second Trump administration. They have leaned on, I think, Apple and others to remove apps that were used to document ICE activities, and content that was critical of ICE activities. It's a nice instrument to be able to use as a government, right? Because you have that indirect power. But obviously it subverts the First Amendment.
And you guys talk about how in Murphy v. Missouri, the Supreme Court case, the Supreme Court kind of punted on this, right? They said the case, the people who brought the case didn't have standing, so we're not going to discuss the merits.
Yeah, in the Murphy case, the plaintiffs who were before the Supreme Court, basically to have standing, you have to show that you were injured and it's traceable to the government and it's redressable. And these particular plaintiffs did not have that showing. And the Supreme Court set a very high bar. And to be clear, they're setting that high bar for standing in all sorts of cases. It is very hard to sue in federal court because of the rules of standing as the Supreme Court has articulated. But interestingly, in another case that was decided that it was actually argued the same day, a case called NRA v. Vulo, this was a case where the Supreme Court ruled against the New York financial services regulator, who was basically really strongly pressuring financial institutions that were doing business with the NRA. She disagreed with the NRA's messages, and the record in that case was pretty abhorrent, what she was doing. And the Supreme Court set, I think, a pretty reasonable test to say this is what jawboning looks like. Unfortunately, that was an offline context, so we don't really have great guidance as to what it looks like for social media companies, just because it was,
you know, as we shift to social media as kind of the public square and whatnot, what about, you know, how censorial or censorious, whichever is the right term, are the platforms themselves becoming, either because they fear government intervention or because Elon Musk says I'm a free speech absolutist, but he clearly isn't, and he wants his platform to reflect his priorities or his judgments. You know, is there also a turn in the private sector towards, you know, clamping down on speech?
It depends on which year you're asking about, because I think right now is different than 2 or 3 years ago, at least if you're talking about the big platforms like Meta. The Supreme Court actually about 2 years ago ruled in a case where Texas and Florida were actually trying to limit the ability of social media companies to moderate content, saying you can't moderate for certain reasons. And the Supreme Court, again, did not rule on the merits. There was a technical reason that they didn't issue a final ruling, but they gave some pretty strong guidance saying that platforms have First Amendment rights to determine both what stays up on their platforms and what comes off of their platforms.
And these laws were passed in red states,
yes,
basically to make sure that conservatives were not being pushed off the platforms or conservative politicians.
Yes. But I mean, interestingly, they could be used if California were to pass a law saying you must remove hate speech or other misinformation or other speech we don't like. So the precedent in that case, I think, can be useful overall to say this is left up to the platform's discretion. But of course, platforms are subject to all of the informal political pressures, whether to keep speech up or take it down.
But I don't think like the general trajectory from like, say, 2010 to now has been for platforms, especially the big centralized one, to adopt more and more restrictive policies and enforcement. Then there was the so-called vibe shift when Trump came into power, but I think that has fizzled out a little bit. And as you mentioned, like Elon Musk came in as a free speech absolutist, but very quickly found that he had, you know, the ring of Sauron and was unable to resist its power.
You guys note that, you know, he instituted or kept community notes, but then got really pissed when people started doing community notes on his post, pointing out how.
But I mean, I have to say, like, community notes is actually one of the things that we highlight in the book as as a very useful, practical tool.
Right. Let's talk about social media and kids. You guys have written about the recent rulings, both in New Mexico and then also the civil case in L.A., where social media was, you know, lost. Court cases, social media. I mean, it's actually, I guess it's like Meta and YouTube or Google, right? But they lost in court because they weren't protecting kids enough. Is this, I guess, first, is this the face of censorship now? We're going to be protecting kids by restricting access to social media.
I think it makes it a whole lot easier to censor. I think it's a reason that has caught on in the media, among politicians, just in public opinion. And as I said earlier, the two most compelling justifications over time for censorship in the U.S. have been national security and children, protecting children. And this recent wave over the past year or so of, you know, harms to children from social media is really driving a lot of changes. I mean, it's driving changes in the courts, where the courts are basically ignoring Section 230. They've basically written it out of existence.
Well, this is the genius, right? If the recent or the recent verdicts are that we're not talking about speech. So Section 230 doesn't apply. These are design features that make social media addictive to kids, which then causes them social harms. Why is that wrong?
Well, in terms of Section 230, it still comes down to user-generated content. I mean, that this is what they're saying is causing the harm is the content that is being provided to children on social media. And Section 230 very clearly says that you are, if you're an online service, you're not treated as the publisher or speaker of content someone else creates. And it was intended, when you talk with Chris Cox and Ron Wyden, who wrote Section 230, it was intended to preserve the editorial discretion of these platforms to decide how to present the content, whether to take it down or keep it up. And I mean, the court rulings that have basically said, let's write Section 230 out of existence, have basically ignored all of that history, all of the precedent, and all of the logic behind 230.
When, you know, and so you're arguing that if social media was all, you know, forget about the design elements, but it was just VeggieTales and Teletubbies, you know, they're arguing that it would still be addictive because of the design features. And you're saying, no, it's the content is why people are using it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Talk a bit about how, you know, one of the big arguments, and this is, you know, Meta has, you know, voluminous internal documents saying, oh yeah, we want to keep people coming back, you know, et cetera. They're now like tobacco. Jacob, why is social media like tobacco? Is it addictive and harmful? Or where does that analogy go wrong?
Yeah, no, I think it resonates a lot. You know, I have two teenage kids, and I struggle with it. You know, I have stringent parental controls. There are certain platforms they're not allowed to. They have a maximum time. And I do think that there are certain kids that can be harmed by social media. But I also think that, and I'm not a social scientist, but there is definitely a lot of studies out there that dispute the claim that there's like causality, clear causality between screen, social media use, and teen mental health issues. But even if we assume that someone like Jonathan Haidt is right, I don't think that justifies the kind of laws. First of all, the tobacco analogy, I think, is really, really simplistic and wrong. Like, no one in their right mind would disagree with the fact that if you smoke tobacco, that is clearly dangerous for you in the long term. And there are no real, like, you might have social benefits, but there are no benefits like related to speech. Whereas my kids, we moved to the United States for 3 years ago. One of the reasons why they are fluent in English, one of the reasons why my daughter can now speak with a southern twang because we live in Tennessee, is because, you know, they've been on social media. My son runs a car detailing business. How do you learn how to clean cars? Well, you watch these videos. And so there's a lot of educational material there. So obviously there are huge benefits also for kids. And that has to be the role, first and foremost, of parents to figure out what is the, you know, what are the right conditions for my kids to be on this. But also, you know, these kinds of laws that undermine anonymity have real consequences for adults as well, because they undermine privacy. Now, look at the Enlightenment, look at Voltaire, Spinoza, John Locke, all of authors who published under anonymity or using pseudonyms. Why did they do that? Because they were battling censorship at the time. So anonymous speech, Common Sense by Tom Paine, mm-hmm. right? You know, the Federalist Papers. Has been absolutely essential to creating the democracies, free and open societies that we live in now, and that is being endangered by these kinds of laws.
Let's talk about the solutions you propose, because this book is not simply a catalog of terror and of problems, but you talk about ways to reverse this. And this you talk about Taiwan, of all places, as first off, as a model of radical transparency. What is going on in Taiwan, just briefly, and then let's talk about other ways that we can, you know, kind of reverse the free speech recession.
So Taiwan had many of the challenges that we've been talking about this evening. So they had concerns about COVID and people sort of falling for COVID hoaxes and not adhering to public health measures, and they also had concerns about, very real concerns about foreign election manipulation.
Well, like the United States, and you know, we have Cuba 90 miles away that is threatening to take us over all the time. Yeah. Taiwan has a small country 100 miles away that is threatening it constantly.
And they could have gone the route that is being proposed in the U.S. and to some extent has been
adopted
in Europe.
And that had been a place in Taiwan as long as Chiang Kai-shek was around, right?
Yes.
Which was like authoritarian control of media.
And their approach was completely different, which is radical transparency, which is let's build trust with the public, both for COVID and for election misinformation. So we profile their former digital affairs minister who recorded all of her meetings and posted them publicly to show, you know, this is what I'm doing, this is what I'm talking about. The public health minister during COVID would constantly be giving press conferences and posting information, good and bad, everything in between. And people would trust the government because the government was, I mean, it is a radical concept, being honest and providing the good, the bad, the ugly.
This is not unlike Donald Trump talking with the Easter Bunny next to him, ranting about
exactly, you know, the same
various
thing.
Things, right?
Yeah, but also they actually, so Community Notes, we mentioned before, mm-hmm. Taiwan was pioneering crowdsourced fact checking. So Audrey Tang, the Minister of Digital Affairs, she actually came out of a hacker movement that sort of temporarily occupied parliament and then became sort of part of the government. And these were these young, cool, very tech-savvy kids who thought the government was out of touch. And they implemented all of these policies that patched and updated Taiwanese democracy to the digital age in ways that we haven't done in older traditional democracies. No. And so have this organic bottom-up approach much more than a top-down approach to controlling speech like misinformation.
You guys also talk about, you know, decentralizing the public square, which, you know, is the public square everybody participates in, but it's not necessarily public property. But how do we decentralize things? Because, you know, there are a couple of major kingdoms out there, right? There's, you know, whatever Google or Alphabet, whatever they're calling themselves now, controls, and Amazon and Apple and Meta. How do we decentralize that? Or is it already, they're kind of feuding with each other, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because of network effects, where basically some services like social media become more valuable when there are more users. So a social media network with 1,000 people is not going to be terribly useful. And so it's hard to overcome, but there are proposals and there have been services that are interoperable that allow people to move between services. There's something called middleware, where basically the content moderation is preferences are set by the user rather than a big platform. And the idea is, in all of these experiments, is rather than have one gigantic company that has its own political agenda and can be influenced by the government, instead spread that power out to individuals. Now, it's not worked great yet. I mean, we have things like Mastodon, we have Blue Sky, which are experiments in this, and they have their critics, they have their fans. But it's at least, I think it's heartening to at least see the attempts to go beyond these gigantic centralized platforms.
But I actually think Community Notes is a good example of this. Take the situation after Alex Preddy was killed in Minnesota by Border Patrol agents. So very quickly, the narrative in the Trump administration was this is a domestic terrorist. He had, you know, essentially brought it on by himself. And because people have smartphones and could record this from various angles, users, media organizations, and so on, could verify what actually happened. And so within hours, Kash Patel, Kristi Noem, the DHS account, and Stephen Miller were all community noted. Mm-hmm. And these were not, you know, this was not a top-down fact check by, you know, institutional fact checkers. Right. This was ordinary users of X, a platform which is not exactly hostile to the Trump administration. And the beauty of the community notes is that it's essentially like a bridging algorithm. So it's not enough for super liberal users to say, well, Stephen Miller is lying. You only get a visible community note if a critical mass of people with different ideological perspectives agree that this is useful, this is documented, that this person...
And it's neutral language.
Yeah. So it's like, again, it's like...
I don't know how many people here participate in community notes on Twitter, but there's a whole checklist of, you know, it's got to be a good source, it's got to be relevant, it's got to be clear and challenging things, and it has to be neutral.
And so that builds trust, because you can no longer just like... If Stephen Miller is fact-checked by the New York Times, he's probably going to take it as a badge of honor, right?
Right.
But this is ordinary people. So it becomes much more difficult as a big influencer, as a politician, to just say, well, I don't care.
Right.
And so if crowdsourced fact-checking, which is also being rolled out on Meta platforms, YouTube, and so on, if that really becomes the norm, it has the potential to act as a disincentive against the most types of right. brazen line, because it becomes shameful to be.
Well, and then you guys also talk about counter speech aimed at what you call the movable middle. So, you know, there's, you know, certain people on extremes are not going to be convinced by good arguments, but there's a lot of people in the middle. You know, talk what goes into counter speech, and then put a generational spin on this, because, you know, it seems, and I hate to be a boomer, but it's also true of Gen Xers, but it's like, you know, boomers and Gen Xers came of age at that peak moment of the internet and of like, okay, this is free. We're kicking free of the rusted out hulks of old industrial era governments, and anything goes. And the worst thing you can say it on cyberspace and everybody can hear it or not. And it seems to me that younger people now seem to be more to find hate speech or so-called hate speech more problematic, more frequent. And, you know, millennials and Gen Z seem to be more censorial than boomers. Maybe not. But, you know, what is counter speech and how is that going to play out generationally?
So you're absolutely right. You know, so at the Future of Free Speech, we did this survey of attitudes towards free speech in 33 countries around the world. And the U.S. actually saw the third largest drop in tolerance for controversial ideas, with the largest drop in the demographic of people between 18 and 34 years old. But counter speech is essentially, I mean, it's not a new phenomenon. So if you read Frederick Douglass's autobiography, you see an introduction foreword by William Lloyd Garrison, where he talks about listening to Douglass speak in Nantucket, I think in 1841. And he sort of talks about like how the crowd is absolutely mesmerized by Douglass. And he writes, "I think I never hated slavery so much as in that very moment." So you can see, like, these are words that are just viscerally touching people. And they say, well, slavery is an evil. It mobilizes an abolitionist movement to push back against it. And so there's actually a lot of empirical data surveys that show that online counter speech can help. So again, at the Future of Free Speech, we've distilled it into these toolkits that we can use. And sometimes the right strategy is humor. Sometimes it's empathy. Sometimes it's shaming. There's a great Brazilian campaign where this black weather woman, she was the first black weather woman to be to be featured at a prominent news station, and she was inundated with hate speech on social media. So what they did, a civil society organization, was to print out some of the worst statements about her and put them physical billboards in the actual neighborhoods where people who had said that lived, sort of to confront people. You know, this is not a theoretical problem, that racism still exists in Brazil. This is something we have to take serious. And that created a huge debate. And a lot of people actually took down their posts. And there's a great moving interview where someone sort of who perpetrated or, you know, engaged in hate speech apologizes. So these are strategies where I think that the theory of change is to say a lot of people are motivated today to say, if we see something problematic online, we're going to go to the government or social media platforms to say we demand, you know, tougher speech. But then you have this censorship envy. If group A wants, you know, protection against certain types of speech, group B wants as well, and group C, and so on. So that's a censorship race to the bottom. Counter speech is a way to sort of, you know, operationalize the old cliche of fighting bad speech with better speech.
Let's leave it there. Jeff Kossoff, Jacob Mshangama. The book is The Future of Free Speech. Thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.